Maybe I'm a hike. Honestly, I haven't.
Okay. Let's start as follows. When I came back to Yeshiva 13 years ago, so I went to meet with Reb Lichtenstein to talk about issues that related to my life. One of the things I wanted to talk to him about was, you know, I learned Ramban ala Parsha, Ramban ala Torah, and whenever it gets to Al Derech HaEmes, Al Pi HaSod, Al Derech Kabbalah, I skip it, because that's what everybody said. I said, but now I'm more than 40, you know, huh?
No.
Yeah, I am. And so I went to see him. So I said, you know, I basically said all that. I said, now that I'm more than 40, I was thinking, well, he said, now the Ramban says in his Akdama that it's not for people like me and you. So it was hysterical that he said people like me and you. So I was like, what do we have in common? And then I have two legs, you have two legs, you know. But, and we're both very firm. Okay, so, you know, he said if you didn't learn it, Rebbe Mipi Talmud, the Ramban says it in Hakdama. Whether that's really true about Rav Lichtenstein or not, I don't know. Like, if he didn't understand the Kabbalah of the Ramban, it's true about me. Okay, I don't understand the Kabbalah of the Ramban. I don't understand Kabbalah generally. So what are we going to do today? So the first thing we're going to do is try to just understand how Kabbalah took off and when the Ari lived and how he interacted and where he fit in. Then we'll make some attempt to understand basic concepts in Kabbalah. I have no guarantee that I'm telling it to you right or that it makes any sense. We'll try with that, and we'll see also how it may have been a predecessor to Hasidus. Okay, let's start as follows. The Arizal is Rav Yitzchok Luria. Arizal means lion, Ha'ari, Ari HaKadosh, Adonenu Rabbi Yitzchok, Eloki Rabbi Yitzchok. All these things, you know, might be why he's called the Ari. The most important thing to realize is that he only lived 38 years. It's unbelievable for a person to have the impact that he had and live only 38 years. How does that happen? When you don't write anything, he wrote like a few Zmiros for Shabbos, but that's pretty much it. The answer is, it doesn't matter how long you live if you began a movement and if you have Talmidim, both of which the Ari had, and therefore, you know, it doesn't matter they didn't live that long. Okay. Another introductory comment. It's very, very, very hard to distinguish fact from fiction in the life of the Ari, right? The book, the Shivchei HaAri, has amazing stories. It's hard to know what really happened and what might have happened. But these are the things we know, okay? He was born in Yerushalayim. His father was Ashkenazi. His mother was Sephardi. Okay, so he kind of represented both sides. There's a story of Eliyahu HaNavi meeting his father and telling him, you'll have a son, you'll call him Yitzchak, blah. Okay. But what matters is as follows. His father dies in his youth. He's really, really young when his father dies. And he's raised in Egypt by uncles. Okay, his mother has brothers, and they raise him. Including one of his uncles is Rav Bezalel Ashkenazi. Anybody know who that is? Correct. He wrote the Shita Mekubetzes. Excellent. He wrote the Shita Mekubetzes, and apparently the Ari helped him write the Shita Mekubetzes. Okay? Very important to understand that the Ari was a genuine Talmud Chacham. He wasn't just some mystic. Right? As we've said before, and we'll say again, if you want to have the impact that the Ari had, you need to first be great in regular learning, and then you could go to Nistar, and then you could do it, because if you're not great in regular learning, so then people can just dismiss you. Oh, he's playing around with these ideas because he doesn't know how to do real learning. Okay? The Ari knew real learning, the Ari worked on and helped with major Sfarim, and that gave him sort of the background, and maybe even the confidence, to get involved. Okay, he got married at 15 to a rich cousin. Why do I say that? Because basically his life was set. He didn't need a real job. He could just learn because she had a lot of money. At some point, he turns to asceticism and mysticism. At 22, he began learning Zohar. Now, why did he start learning Zohar at 22? Because it had recently been printed for the first time. Okay, now, why does this matter? It matters based on, it matters because it may reveal, and it may not, who wrote the Zohar. Okay, now we say, and I have no reason not to think it's true, that Rav Shimon bar Yochai wrote the Zohar. But then in the 1500s, somebody else found it and published it. I'll just say this. If the somebody else who found it and published it actually wrote it, it wouldn't make a difference to me. You know, because the Ari took it and made something more of it. But that's a major discussion in intellectual Jewish history, if Rav Shimon bar Yochai really wrote the Zohar or not. Again, I don't think it matters at all. Okay, so he begins learning Zohar, and he lives in a cabin on the bank of the Nile, on some island that an uncle of his owned, and he only comes home on Shabbos. And even when he comes home on Shabbos, he doesn't talk much, and he only speaks Hebrew. It's all very, you know, creepy, whatever. Okay? But then, in 1569, he comes to Tzfat. Whether it's because he got a vision, and God told him to come to Tzfat, or he thought of it on his own, he did. Okay? Tzfat, at the time and ever after, was the center for the study of Kabbalah. And at the time, it was led by Rav Moshe Cordovero. Okay? He was a huge Kabbalist, and he had like a school around him. But Rav Moshe Cordovero dies pretty soon after the Ari gets there, and the Ari becomes the leader of the group. His greatest Talmud is Rav Chaim Vital. But other Talmidim also include the Mechaber, Rav Shlomo Alkebetz, Rav Yaakov Beirav, etc. Except that not all the Talmidim are equal. Meaning, he has close Talmidim who he shared the secrets of Kabbalah with. He did not share it with the Mechaber. Rav Yosef Karo was not zochet to be one of his close Talmidim Kabbalistically. There's all these stories, and they may be true, that the Ari said to him, you're supposed to do Nigla, and I'm supposed to do Nista, even though, you know, the Mechaber had a voice that spoke to him and that told him all these things. Still, the Ari did not allow the Mechaber to be too close to him, because again, the Mechaber's role was in Nigla, and the Ari's role was in Nistar. Okay. Now, let's back up a little bit. In 1492, there's an expulsion from Spain. Many of these Jews come to Tzfat, and many of them felt like a personal urgency and responsibility to bring the Mashiach. You know, like, there's two times where you think Mashiach is going to come, when things are great or when things are terrible. So here things were terrible, and they thought it meant the Mashiach is going to come, okay? Like, to bring the Mashiach, you needed, you know, close kinships, ascetic practices, not aesthetic. It also required, in their mind, the popularization of the Ari's Kabbalah. Okay, or said another way, Lurianic Kabbalah, which is what it's called, was there to bring the Mashiach. Nothing less, nothing more. Okay, now, let's talk about the Zohar. So what does the Zohar mean? It means splendor, it means radiance, it means beauty. It's the foundational work of Kabbalah. It's about the nature of God, the origin and structure of the universe, the nature of souls, redemption. It's sort of like the metaphysical structure of the world. Now again, you could go through life without knowing any Kabbalah, and I think you'd be fine. But if you want to understand the metaphysical structure of the world, how God created the world, what the parts of the world are, you turn to Kabbalah. Okay, again, it was published in the 13th century in Spain by Rav Moshe de Leon, who may have wrote it, probably didn't. Again, he said it was the work of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, who lived in the 2nd century, who was inspired by the person who appeared to him, whose name, his last name is Hanavi, his first name is Eliyahu. Okay, he shows up a lot in the book. It makes it Torah HaSod, etc. Okay. let's do some Kabbalistic terms. How's about that? Let's talk about tikkun. Tikkun, okay? How does God create the world? Well, if God is the Ein Sof, which means, literally, no end. He's infinite. So there's no room in the world for me and you. God occupies the entire world. So if God's going to create the world, what does he have to do? Simtzum. He has to contract. He has to make himself smaller so that there's room for other things. Okay, so the first basic idea of Kabbalah is Tzimtzum. Now, they describe in all different ways, you know, the Ari system of Kabbalah means God left a round circle in the middle, which kind of expanded. It could be a square, but the Ari thinks that a circle is a more perfect form than a square. So it leaves a circle in the middle, which expands. Okay? Now, what's the problem with Tzimtzum? The problem is that when God retracted from the center of the earth, he left particles behind. Just bear with me for a second now. The easiest way to explain is you take a water bottle and you shake it out. Okay, no matter how much you shake, what's left? Some tiny bits of water are left in the water bottle. So when God was mitzamtzem himself, kiviyachol, he left pieces of himself in the world. Pieces of himself that are called klipos or nitzotzot or all kinds of other words, which we have to liberate. I mean, we have to like redeem these nitzotzot that are left in the world. It's another way of saying that God needs our help. Okay, so how do you liberate them? Well, every religious act requires contemplative concentration to raise up the nitzotzot. What's contemplative concentration? This is where you get to the beginning of Hasidus, meaning it's not enough that I wash my hands. I need to say hinni muchan, I need to have great kavana that my hand washing should be done perfectly, right? It's not enough that I learn. I need to have great kavana. It's not enough that I make brachos, it's not enough that I daven. The acts themselves are not critical. What's critical is the thought behind them. What's critical is the intention behind them. What's critical is the kavana behind them. Okay? Tikkun olam is a phrase that you hear a lot, although nowadays you hear it mostly in the sense of politics. But tikkun olam in the old days was freeing up the nitzotzot that were stuck in flawed material creation. One second. Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
Like we should take the little God particles here and push it out from where God is.
No, so you can't see them, you can't touch them, you can't. What you could do is mitzvos.
What does it mean to redeem them? Does it mean that they're no longer in the world?
Do we want to keep them here?
Huh? Yeah, that's no, we have to give them back to God. We have to give them.
To get all of God out of the universe.
It sounds bad when you say it that way, I admit. The goal is not to get God out of the universe, because God exists in the universe. The goal is to redeem the nitzotzot. Now, what happens then when you redeem them, I don't know. I'm really just sharing what I know. But what's important is, when you do a mitzvah, right, you do it with complete focus and concentration. You don't just do the act. When you make a bracha, you have complete focus and concentration on that bracha. That helps redeem the nitzotzot. What happens to them after that, I don't know. Yes?
Is this something that they believe is literal? Or they thought, like, oh, this is a way to get people to do kavanah when they do mitzvah? Or this is
no, I think the Ari thought it was literal.
Oh.
I really do. I mean, we could have kavanah without the Ari's kavanah.
Yeah. So where did he get this from?
From the Zohar. Huh? Well, you either buy into it or you're not. Or you don't. Okay, it makes everything more personal because either you're successful or you're not, right? You keep Shabbos and you sanctify Shabbos and you focus on Shabbos and do all these things. That's great. And if you don't, that's not great. Each commandment has a particular mystical meaning. Okay, again, you don't just do the act. it has a meaning behind it. Shabbos, with all its ceremonies, was looked upon as the embodiment of the divinity in temporal life. Right? The greatest day of the world is Shabbos. Every ceremony performed on that day was considered to have an influence upon the superior world. That's the world that God lives in. Okay? That's a basic idea in Kabbalah. Now, since the Ari didn't write any of this down, who wrote it down? So the answer is Rav Chaim Vital wrote it down in 8 volumes called the Eitz Chaim. Okay? Fine. Rav Chaim Vital. Okay, here we go. Now, let's look at an example. There's a major machlokas harishonim about wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Okay? It's just a regular machlokas. But the Zohar shows up and says not to. And the Zohar says, like, you're a bad person if you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And that becomes the dominant position. The way it seems to me, in Israel, nobody wears tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Right? In America, people do. In Israel, they don't. Okay? Now, what is the role of Zohar in formulating halacha? Okay, this is an important point. So the answer is we don't paskin like the Zohar against the Gemara. Okay, but in a post-Talmud machlokes, we do allow Kabbalah to decide. So for example, on Rosh Chodesh, taking off tefillin before Musaf, that comes from the Kabbalah. Yes?
Sorry, when you say we don't paskin like the Zohar against the Gemara, does the Zohar often disagree with the Gemara?
Not often, but sometimes.
Okay.
What?
Tonight's source.
Okay, so we ignore the Zohar. That's just the fact. Here's the Mishnah Berurah. In Simon Chaf Hei, the Mishnah Berurah says, Kasav HaKnesset HaGdolu B'chlolei HaPoskim. One, Kol Davar Sheba'alei HaKabbalah V'HaZohar Cholkim Im HaGmara V'HaPoskim Haloch Achar HaGmara. Okay, so if we have in Torah Sheba'al Peh a halacha and the Zohar disagrees with it, then we disregard the Zohar and we pass it like the Gemara. Mihu, im ba'alei kabbalah machmirim, yesh lahachmir. Okay, if the Zohar has a... Now, it's not always clear that you can be machmir in certain cases, but if the Zohar has a chumrah, he thinks you should keep it. Gamkein. Ve'im lohus kar b'gmara u'beposkim, af al pi shen nizkar b'kabbalah, ein anu yecholim lachof linhokach, V'din she'ein muzkar behefech b'shas u'poskim yesh l'leich achar divrei kabbalah. V'gam b'makom she'ish plugda b'hein ha'poskim divrei kabbalah yachriya. Okay, so what it means is essentially, Kabbalah is not an independent source of law, but when you can pass in like the Kabbalah, you do. Okay. Let's look at 2 sources or ideas that the Ari supported. The Ari thought, this is actually quoted in regular sources, quoted in the Chaya Adam and in other places, that you're supposed to be mekabel on yourself at the beginning of Shachris, the mitzvah v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Okay, so that could just be a nice idea. Okay, before I daven, I think I'm going to be mekabel on myself, the mitzvah v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. But there's a deeper idea within it. And that is as follows. In Kabbalah, the more you unify a group, the stronger the group becomes and the better the group becomes. So says the Ari, one, I want my tefillah to be a tefillah b'tzibur, which means I want my tefillah to be accepted amongst all the tefillahs of Klal Yisrael. So to do that, I have to associate with Klal Yisrael. So the first thing is I accept on me the mitzvah v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. But there's a deeper idea. Says the Ari, you know, one of the ways to bring Mashiach is to unify people. Okay? So if you have a friend who's struggling with something, kamocha means that you're struggling with that thing also. If you have a friend who's celebrating something great, kamocha means you're also celebrating something great. If you can reach a madrega where you do that, so then you've attached yourself to other Jews. You've attached yourself to Klal Yisrael generally. And therefore, the Ari says, your davening becomes much more significant. Okay? let's do a story. The story of the Lechem Apanim. Okay?
There were, as I mentioned before, Anusim. What are Anusim?
Fish are they converted?
Correct. They were Maranos. They had to do stuff they weren't supposed to do. Okay? They came to Tzfat. There was a person who went to a shir on the Lechem. And the Rav mentioned that, you know, Lechem Apanim is such a wonderful mitzvah, and it's so sad that we can't do it anymore, and God can't get the Lechem Apanim, and God can't reward us for it, etc., etc. This guy then has a great idea. He goes home, and he tells his wife, I need you to make special bread every Friday. Okay, now, how do you do that? You have to sift it 13 times. You have to make it with great kedusha, whatever it is. He tells his wife to do it. So she does it. So the first Friday, he takes fresh, beautiful, two challahs to shul. And he opens the Aron Kodesh. And he says, God, I'm giving you this lechem upon him for you to enjoy. He speaks beautifully, speaks passionately, speaks with great commitment. And he puts the bread, the challah, in the Aron Kodesh. Okay, and he leaves. In the afternoon, the shamash comes to shul, opens the Aron Kodesh, sees the two breads, and takes them, and eats them. He's thrilled to eat the bread. Okay? The guy comes back at night, on Friday night, he looks in the Aron Kodesh, the bread's gone. He's thrilled, right? He's so excited, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu took his bread, in like the simplest understanding, God took his bread and ate his bread. Okay? That becomes his custom. He comes every... What?
Isn't that hero?
We'll come to your part of the story in a second. Okay? This becomes his custom. Every Friday, his wife bakes the bread. He brings it. He speaks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He leaves it in the Aron Kodesh. The Shamash comes, eats it. He comes back at night. The bread is gone. He's thrilled. Okay. At some point, the rabbi, who had actually given the shir, is in shul on Friday. But our guy, who's so excited to meet God and to feed him, doesn't notice. And he's speaking to God. And he puts the bread in the Aron Kodesh. And the rabbi says to him, what are you doing? So he says, I'm putting the bread in the Aron Kodesh because of Lechem Apanim, and he once told us in a shir. And God takes it and eats, and he says, you're an idiot. He's like a caulker. He says, you're against the halacha. God doesn't have a mouth. God doesn't have hands. God doesn't take your food. God doesn't do any of that. So he says, but the challah's gone every week. So he said, yeah, because the shamash eats it. And the shamash comes, and they ask him, and he says, yeah. And he's not embarrassed. He eats it. So the guy is depressed. Okay? And the Arizal calls in the rabbi and tells him, say goodbye to everybody, you're dying tomorrow. This is like, what are you talking about? I told the guy the truth. He said, since the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, God hasn't had pleasure like he has from this guy's chalas. When this guy comes and gives him the chalas, and speaks to him like a son to his father, God is thrilled. And you've stopped this, so you're going to die tomorrow. Now, he does die tomorrow. That's the story. I don't mean you. Okay? The point is, what offended the Arizal about it? The answer is, sure, the guy didn't know. But his action was so sincerely motivated. Right? His action was so pure. He made bread for God. It happens to be that God doesn't really eat bread. It happens to be that the shamash showed up and he ate it. It's all true. But the Ari says, you've taken away the beauty, the deep purity and beauty of what this guy did. And that's what makes God happy. Yes?
What if I, for example, want to make all the brachos in the world to make God happy, and I go on to make bracha on bacon and shellfish and the like, or I want to be...
You don't have to make a bracha on treif. Don't worry.
He wants to make all the brachas in the world, so he makes brachas on stuff. As in, the point is to do something that you think is good, but at the same time...
Okay, so I get it. This is a good example of what's great and what's less great about the Ari's approach and about Kabbalah, right? I would tell you that if you're doing it the way you're doing it, so you make the mistake. If you're doing it the way this Anus was doing it, you're doing the most beautiful thing in the world.
And if you want to bring Korbanos and we're all coming in, you don't have a Parah Duma, no one would say, even if you want to bring a Korban.
I don't know. If a guy doesn't know anything and he's motivated purely, the Ari might support it. I don't know.
No, but if he's going to not do it if you tell him the wrong thing, then you should tell him because it's...
Says you. Says you. Says you. The Ari thinks otherwise. I'm just going to double down. The Ari thinks if you're doing something out of a pure sense of motivation, that something is worth more than whatever you're doing. Yes.
Do you think the mistake of the story was the way the rabbi told him, or is it actually
the story? When you're reading it, you go right away, this rabbi's in trouble. There's no way this is going to end well for the rabbi. I don't know if it's the way, I suppose it's the way he told me, he wouldn't die otherwise. But I'm using it just for the point of the story, which is, if you do it out of pure motivation, you're going to get rewarded. If your motivation really is pure, yes.
I'll also note, I've heard a slightly different version of the story, where there's a really, really poor guy who's come to the shul, and he dons Hashem, and he opens up the aron and gets the challah, and that by doing it, the rabbi stopped positive action of also giving...
Okay. Okay, could be right. Yeah. What? I don't know. I really don't know. It just could be if you have to do Tzimtzum, that's the price you pay.
So isn't that true?
No, because if God did not make God perfect.
No. I don't know what's, is there something in the Rambam that says if you say there are pieces of God left over, you're kofar? I don't think so. Look, what we found, what we're finding is, this is exactly the point. Now, there are a lot of people who say that the Arizal was used later on by Shabtai Tzvi in dangerous ways, and maybe that's what you're saying. In which case, you'd be right. What the Arizal is saying is, there's a way to do it that's safe. There's a way to do it that's not safe. Maybe, he's so close to the line, it's hard to know. But the idea that, there are deeper ideas and deeper motivations, and that everything you do, has a meaning someplace else in the world that may not be what you're thinking of, but could be used in a good way, I think the Ari believed deeply. And I think the Ari tried to find secrets of Shabbos, and tried to find secrets of Nigla, tried to find other secrets, but mostly wanted people to invest in their Judaism. Mostly wanted people to feel like when they do something, they're doing it for real, for the purpose of bringing the geula, and it's hard to do more than that. All right, yashkach to everybody. After mincha, we'll do.